parsha, I think I explained a little bit earlier in the week, is that on Thursdays, focus on the parsha. And in order to be able to give proper attention to parts of the parsha that may otherwise not be focused on, if we always started from the beginning, so the idea is to pick one aliyah each week. So last year, we focused on Rishon every week. Anybody who's interested in hearing about Rishon can go to Wayu Torah and look back. But this year, our goal is to focus on Sheni every week. So that gives us an opportunity to focus more on Psukim that otherwise we'd have to rush through even more quickly. And that's especially valuable today. Of course, Parshas Kisetze is chock full. And if you start from the beginning, it's very hard to get too deeply into Parshas Kisetze because there's so much to talk about. But also, I feel like we have a heavenly assistance in general when we look for synergy. So we have a lot of synergy today because our agenda is the next time we meet to start talking about Eilu Metzias. By the way, again, just to confirm, the next time will be, God willing, on Monday on a Sunday schedule, Sunday agenda and Sunday schedule. So 11:30 on Monday. I don't think, Jonathan, we have confirmation on what room.
No.
We don't, so I guess we'll have to listen out for what room it is. There was some possibilities. Still up in the air what room it is. So we'll have to find out on Monday. Well, this building will be closed, but whatever it is. But so our next agenda is to look to Eilu Metzias. So there's a lot of synergy here because the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda is found in this second aliyah of Kisetze. Of course, the deck is a little bit stacked when you talk about synergy because Parshas Kisetze tends to be the beginning of the year, and because there are so many different mitzvos in Parshas Kisetze, so many mesechtes that you would be learning would tend to have some kind of connection in Parshas Kisetze, so the odds are really in your favor in terms of finding synergy the way things are set up. But in any event, so we have a major synergy opportunity here, so the question is just how much to avail ourselves of that, because since there is a long list of things to talk about, even in this relatively brief aliyah. So maybe we want to leave some of the Hashavas Aveda topics for the Eilu Metzias, so maybe we want to take advantage of this as an introduction, so we'll probably land somewhere in between. So let's try to start from the beginning of Sheni and see how much we can talk about. So first the Torah talks about somebody being executed. So there are certain types of neragim. It's only a very limited list of people who, if they're executed, so there also has to be a public awareness, l'man yishmu v'yiro, that people should know that certain types of averus are perhaps underappreciated in terms of their severity, and it has to be made clear. So in that category, the executed person is hung on a tree. And the Chazal emphasized that that's not the way they're executed. That's not considered to be an acceptable method of execution among the different Harugei Bezdin. So hanging is not one of them. This is a hanging of a person who's already been executed. Zalman Zaratskin, in his Aznayim Latoris, he suggests that he thinks that this is considered to be an inhumane way of killing people. Now, we know that the Torah is searching for ways that are considered to be relatively humane, even though there is a sliding scale of severity. But the Pasuk says, this is not the context in which we usually think of this Pasuk, but the Gemara Sanhedrin understands the Pasuk, v'ahav t'l'recha kamocha, of all things, b'ror lo misa yafa, that we look for a humane way of imposing execution. So the way he understands it is that when somebody is hung, so their own body weight, they are themselves a participant in the process of execution, and that's too much to ask of somebody, that we wouldn't execute somebody that way. So therefore the Gemara emphasizes this is not the method of execution, this is post-execution. But what happens after that? So then we have a prohibition, lo salu nivlaso al ha'etz ki kavor tikvarenu biyom hahu ki kilas elokim talui v'lo sitamei esad masacha asher Hashem elokecha nosen l'chonacho. So the Torah tells us a couple of things. It sounds like you could have a number of mitzvot in this one pasuk alone, all addressing the same thing. It depends on how you count. And there's a big machlokus for showing him how you count and when you count. But there are potentially two prohibitions and one mitzvah saseh in this pasuk. There is a mitzvah saseh of kavur to kvura, there's a chiyuv of kvura, and there is a prohibition of lo salin, that you shouldn't allow this to be delayed, halona sameis, and that you shouldn't allow this to therefore be metameh sa'aretz, and that could theoretically be counted as a separate prohibition. So there's a whole discussion when they all apply. The Ramban seems to assume that all three apply in Eretz Yisrael. Outside of Eretz Yisrael, you don't have all three. So that's a discussion. Different Rishonim have different ways of counting this. There is an issue in terms of, let's say, Halanas Hameis, to focus on that for a second before the mitzvah of Kvura. So Halanas Hameis, the Gemara understands that it depends why you're doing it. That theoretically, you're not supposed to delay a funeral. Unless it's lechvodo, if it's being done for the honor of the mace, that the mace is not going to have a proper kavod, is not going to have a proper kavod achron, there's not going to be significant attendance at the funeral as much as there could have been if enough time is allowed to properly get the word out and allow people to travel, so then that's justifiable. Then that's considered to be lechvodo within limits. So there is a difference in practice between Chutz La'aretz and Eretz Yisrael in terms of this, that Eretz Yisrael is more of a tendency to avail oneself of that heter, which is already in Chazal, it's not a modern heter, but in Eretz Yisrael, especially in Yerushalayim, so there's a somewhat different attitude, perhaps because of those Rishonim who understood the Yisurim to apply specifically in Eretz Yisrael. There is a Gemara Bava Kamma, the Mishnah Bava Kamma, and Daf Pei Beis. So there is a line, Ein Malinin Es Hameis B'Yerushalayim, that specifically in Yerushalayim, there's apparently an additional issue of Halanas Hameis. The Rashi over there comments that this is a Mesorah that we don't really have an explanation for, but that this is a tradition, that we have an extra concern about Halanas Hameis in Yerushalayim. The Radbaz suggests that it's because of Tumah, that somehow there's a higher sensitivity to Tumah in Yerushalayim, and therefore we have a greater urgency to bury the deceased. So if that's the consideration, if it's about Tumah, and it's therefore tied into Kedushas Yerushalayim, so then as Rav Shmuel Salant points out, it's quoted in the Sefer Gesher HaChaim, so then presumably this would apply specifically in the Old City. So that makes sense. But nonetheless, there are a lot of halachos, and we could talk about this more if we had more time to focus on this aspect, there are a lot of concepts that are about Yerushalayim that are relevant specifically to the Old City, at least in theory, when in practice we extend them to all of what we call Jerusalem today, even though halachically Jerusalem probably has different boundaries than classic Yerushalayim, so the minig is to apply this notion to Yerushalayim, and therefore if somebody passes away in Yerushalayim, Chalila, so there is a much greater urgency attached to the funeral. So the funerals take place at night, they take place immediately afterwards. In America, they don't let you have funerals at night. So the unions control the system in the cemeteries, so the workers in the cemeteries, they don't work at night, so they're not going to open up a cemetery in the middle of the night. So we tend not to have funerals in America at night. But in Yerushalayim, you don't have the same issue. And on the other hand, you also have this concern specific to Yerushalayim, perhaps the name Malinas Hameis, on top of this issue of general Halanas Hameis. And therefore, the practice is different. And say, to compare Yerushalayim in America, a funeral will happen much more quickly in Yerushalayim, including 2 o'clock in the morning, including in the middle of the night, which is not something that we see. Not something that we see in America. So Pashtus, there is here a mitzvah of kvura, which applies to everybody, that there is an obligation of kvura for certainly all Jews. Misvari, you could have thought it should apply to non-Jews as well. It's a little bit of a machlokas, but based on the pasuk, Rashi here emphasizes Yisrael, but based on the pasuk that's a kikilos elokim talui, the idea that it's a disgrace for God for somebody to go unburied, so the way many of the commentators understand, that that's a consequence of the fact that humanity is created in seven level kin. So therefore, that applies to all of humanity. It's a pasuk in Bereishis. That's what the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, that Chabib Adam Shenivra B'Tzalem, all of humanity is created B'Tzalem Elokim. So logically speaking, it makes sense that really this should be an inyan for everybody. But it's not 100% clear that's the case. You have to figure out exactly why. But at least there is a mitzvah on Yisrael for Kvura. This has major implications. The question of whether it's a chiyuv gevurah or not, let's say for Nadi Yisrael, is going to have major implications for the question of cremation, other related issues. You know, is it just a question that of how you deal with the mace, or is it a concern that the mace shouldn't be left around? So that's a whole discussion. But certainly for Yisrael, there's a mitzvah of gevurah. And pashtus, that comes from this pasuk, even though this pasuk is talking about Haruge Bezdin, it's not talking about your average upstanding Jew. Nonetheless, we certainly assume there's a mitzvah for all Jews. And that's a whole discussion the Gemara has in the Sanhedrin. It's probably derived from this double lashon of ki kavor tikberenu, that it applies not just to the context of the pasuk of Haruge Bezdin, but it applies to everybody. Even without that extra pasuk, so we often have a style in the Torah that the Torah teaches something in the extreme. So for example, how do I know that I'm not allowed to hit somebody? I'm not allowed to punch somebody in the nose? So that's actually a separate Isser. There's two Isser. There's an Isser to lift up your hand against somebody, as a pasuk in Shmos you're referring to. And then in the context of Malkus, the Torah says, Lo Yosef and Tosef Lakoso, that even when you're hitting somebody, Beheter, we have a din of Malkus, so you still have a prohibition not to add on to that. So we see a Kal Vachomer, that here you have somebody who's Chayav Malkus, who has a mitzvah to hit them, and still, if you go one extra time beyond that, you're over on an Isser. So certainly, if you don't have a mitzvah to hit somebody, so then to start hitting them out of nowhere is for sure aser. Or similarly, the prohibition of embarrassing people in public, amal b'pnei chaverei b'rabim, as the Rambam explains, the Gemara in Erchin derives it from the prohibition in the context of tochacha. We say, ochech tochech misacha, that you should set somebody straight if they're doing the wrong thing. Below siso lav chet, the Gemara says, that you might think I should do so even if I'm going to embarrass them in the process. Yachal afilu yishtane panav, so Talmud lomar, no, lo siso lav chet, that you shouldn't do it in such a way that you're going to cause humiliation. So the Rambam explains that drasha, that that shows us that certainly when we don't have a mitzvah motivation, certainly if we're not motivated by the mitzvah of tochacha, so for sure there's a prohibition to embarrass someone. So the Torah very often gives us an extreme context, and we can figure out that it certainly applies in a less extreme context. So you can't hit somebody who's chayv malchus, certainly you can't hit anyone else. You can't be mavaza somebody in the context of tochacha, certainly you can't be mavaza somebody who's dumb. And you have to bury somebody who was intentionally executed and punished by Bezdin, so certainly you have to bury everybody else. Certainly there is a kal vachomer that is applied there. The Gemara sounds like it's from this lashon of ki kavor tikberenu, and there's a whole discussion in general what is the significance of that dual language, both in the Gemara and later. The Meshech Chachma has a comment that he thinks that it's very clear that when the Torah has a double language like that, it means even 100 times, even if you have to do it a bunch of times. So we're telling you, don't think it's just going to be once. If it has to be more than once, you have to do it as well. So presumably saying that if somebody became disinterred, he had the chiyuv kvura again, still be the same mitzvah. Rabbi Yaakov Emden has a tshuva where he says differently. He thinks the chiyuv kvura is only the first time. That could be related to a whole discussion the Gemara has in Sanhedrin and Daf Mem Vav. So the Gemara talks about the chiyuv of kvura, that this mitzvah that we have for everyone to be buried. And the question is, what is the purpose of kvura? Why do we have such a mitzvah? And the Gemara has two possibilities. Do we say that kvura is mishum bizyone, or kvura is mishum kapara? And on the one hand, you could say that it's because of bizyone, that if the alternative is that a person shouldn't be buried, so then that's going to be a terrible lack of kavod hames. It's going to be a terrible disgrace to the person. So therefore, better they should be buried than left untaken care of. So that's a basic kavod habrios principle. So therefore, maybe it's mishum bizyone. Or the Gemara says, maybe it's not because of that. Maybe it's because of the kapar. That part of the way in which we get an atonement that comes through Misa is then to be put into the ground. So that is a humbling process, so to speak, even though we're not conscious to feel it. But it has a kapar, it has an atonement. And maybe that's the purpose. The Gemara says a nafkamina would be if a person declares he's not interested in kapara, he says he doesn't need to be buried, he's not interested in the kapara. So the Gemara thought maybe that would be a nafkamina, but if it's about bizayin, so then he doesn't have the right on behalf of society to say that he doesn't care about bizayin. It's not just about him, it's about everyone else as well. But if it's about his personal kapara, so then maybe he would have the right to say that he's not interested. So this could also perhaps be relevant to this whole question of the Meshech Chachma and Rabbi Yaakov Emden, that if it's about bizayim, so then if a person becomes disinterred, you'd have to bury them again. It's not about the act of the kavura as much as about the state of being buried. But if it's about the kapara, so maybe it's the initial being placed in the ground, and maybe there's no mitzvah after that, which is harder to say. It's a less likely possibility. Hi.
So you're talking about if this person chooses not to have kapara when he's by being buried. So does that mean that it's like a shlipmara that you just listen to no matter what he says? Or
no, it just sounds like, so it's two ways to read it actually, then what that means. It might mean that, okay, so that he has the right not to want a kapara, or it'll happen anyway for other reasons, but he won't have the kapara, he'll turn off the kapara, he's going to be disconnected from it. But yeah, but maybe if he's not interested in the kapara, that's another way of reading it. But Pashtus, it's Mishum Bizyone, and therefore we do assume that it applies to everyone. And the mitzvah of Kfura is actually a unique mitzvah because it really comes from two different directions. So we read about it in this week's Parsha as kind of a Yoredeya obligation. But we know also that it's an aspect of Chesed. It's one of the greatest Chesedim that can be done for people, which the Torah seems to call it a Chesed Ve'emes. Formulated chesed shel emes, it's true chesed. It's a whole discussion why that is. Rashi says because the person can't pay you back, other portion have other interpretations. It's a little bit of a parshas vayechi topic, but kvura really occupies two spaces in Shulchan Aruch, let's say. It's a Yerodea concept, a general mitzvah, and it's also a particular act of chesed that's done on behalf of others. So some understand that there's a chiyuv on the family members. The family members have a straight out chiyuv, and everyone else who gets involved, if there are no family members or if there are family members but they still need help, as is usually the case, and also to add to the kavod ameis, so that's a chesed. Anyone beyond the members who are actually obligated, so they do so as a chesed. The Ksav Sofer has a comment in one of his shuvas, where he notes on that pasuk, Chesed Be'emes, Parshas and Vayechi, that Yaakov asks Yosef to bury him. He says that it's a Chesed Be'emes. So there are many different interpretations of what the Chesed Be'emes is meant to address. So the Ksav Sofer writes that the fact that he was going to be buried, so that's going to happen anyway. Every society has a way of addressing the hygienic aspects of people dying. They can't not address that. So the chesed was that not so much on the burial, but that Yaakov had said to Yosef, "I'll not tikkureni b'mitzrayim." But it's not just that I'm going to be buried, but I have a preference for how it should happen. I have a preference for how I should be treated at that time. So that's where the chesed comes in. That on the one hand, there is the basic obligation of kvura, but also that a person should be treated in a way that maximizes their kavod, and maximizes their preference, and maximizes the conformity with their will. So all of that is chesed, all of that is an extra element on top of the basic obligation of kvura, which we read about in this week's parsha. Okay, so let's move on from there to the above Metziah topic. So the topic of Hashav v'Saveda. So the Torah says, Lo Sira, es Shor Achicha, Os Sayoni Dochim, V'Hisalam Tamehem, Hashav Teshivem Achicha. So if you see a ox, you see some animal of your friend that's wandering around, so you shouldn't see it and not pay attention. So it doesn't mean you shouldn't see it. It means you shouldn't see it and ignore it, which some understand that that's the interpretation we say in benching all the time, that Nahar Isi Gamzar Hanti Velora Isi Tzadik Nezam, that I've never seen a tzadik who's been abandoned. So what does that mean, I've never seen? Maybe I have seen. Maybe I have in my life seen people who are righteous and who are suffering. So the intent is perhaps not that I haven't seen it, but like we see in this pasuk, that you shouldn't see it and ignore it. So too, I haven't seen it and let it go without attention. So here the Torah says that you shouldn't see it and hide yourself from it. This is basically the newspaper on the subway with the pregnant woman, right? So you're sitting on the subway and the pregnant woman comes on, so you don't want to give up your seat to the pregnant woman, so you pick up your newspaper so it looks like you don't see what's going on, so you can't notice. That's what the Torah is talking about here when it says v'salamta. So it doesn't mean hiding like you're going to hide behind the fence. It means hiding, you hide your eyes, you pretend that you don't see what's going on, so you don't have such an obligation. So the Torah tells us not to do that, that we have an obligation to be aware of it and to do something about it. The Gemara has a drasha, the Gemara in Bava Metzia, which we actually spoke about a little bit last year in the context of Masechet Shabbos as well. We'll probably have the opportunity to talk about it in the context of Eilat Metzias also, that this there is an exception. It's a very important exception, that this idea of Hisalamta, so the Gemara says, ironically, that here the Torah is telling us not to hide, but says the Gemara, Paimim Shata Misalim, there are times when you should hide, there are times when you have the right to conceal yourself from seeing this. So when are these times? So the Gemara says, you have a zakein ve'engel l'fich v'odof. A person is a distinguished personality. He's an elder of stature. And returning this property is going to compromise his kavod, so then he is exempt. He doesn't have to do it. So that's a whole discussion why that is. We talked about that again at length last year. Maybe we'll, in the context of Eilat Metzias, get into it in a little bit more detail. There is this concept of kavod abrios, which is a general Torah concept that has a lot of implications. And one of the implications is that there's an exemption within the realm of Hashavas Aveda, that if returning the property is going to embarrass the person, let's say it's something that it's not dignified for the person to be carrying around, so the person would rather not do this, it's going to embarrass him, so then he's going to be exempt. I say he'd rather not do this because that's also part of the question. The question is sometimes we have to use the standard of would he do it for himself. So if this is the kind of thing that he would carry for his own needs, so then he's not embarrassed. So then if he would do it for himself, he should do it for other people also. But if it's the kind of thing that's not in keeping with his kavod, so he doesn't have to do it for others either. So then he's going to be exempt. And there's a whole discussion whether this means davka a zaken in the sense of a tamar chacham, or it's not about a tamar chacham. It means anybody who's elder and distinguished. You have the mayor from the Monopoly box who's got the top hat and the sash and the mustache and the monocle, so if he's going to go through the garbage dump to return something, so the sash is going to get ripped and the mustache is going to get rumpled and the monocle will get scraped and the hat will get squashed, so that'll be a bizayin. So then maybe that applies to him as well. Pashas, that's probably what it means. There is a lot of discussion about this. One of the primary Talmidim, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, was Rabbi Yitzchak Blazer. Rabbi Yitzchak Blazer was his Talmud both in Musar and in Halacha. So he wrote the Sefer Koch Ve'or, and he also wrote the Tshuvas Pri Yitzchak, a very important Sefer of Shailos and Tshuvas. So in the end of one of the Halakim, the Tshuvas Pri Yitzchak, so he has a lot of Tshuvas back and forth with one of the other primary Talmidim, Rabbi Shaul Salanter, Rabbi Naftali Amsterdam, who this street is named after. So Naftali Amsterdam and him corresponded about this issue, that should we assume that Kavod Abrios means different things, objective things, subjective things. They talked about all the different elements, and one of the things they talked about is the Zaken Vanel of Yichvodo. Is it a Talmud Chacham specifically? Is it anybody distinguished? So that's a whole discussion. There's also probably a Machlokus in the Rishonim about whether or not the Talmud Chacham or the Zaken, whoever, however we define it, does he have the right to be mochel on this? Are we trying to protect his covenant and we say it's kind of an objective standard? Or is this all up to him and he has the right to be mochel? So that's a discussion. The Chavis Yara has a discussion about this, about whether a distinguished person has the right to be a clown at a wedding, to be a letz, to be a badchen. Do we assume it's not l'fichvodo? He has the right to play with that. So that's a whole discussion. Rav Moshe Feinstein has in his Sefer on Chumash, and the Sefer Darash Moshe, that even if we want to say that we have a drasha that the Hisalamta Mehem means that you sometimes should hide from this, but the Pasuk has to mean something literally. So the Pasuk is saying don't hide from this. So what is the intent of the Pasuk? So Rav Moshe has a little Musar Shmuz there, and he says that really one could figure out logically that if we're not supposed to hurt people, and we're not supposed to steal people's things, and we're not supposed to break people's things, so that it makes sense also that not only should we not be the person doing the damage, but we should also help out if possible. We should also do what we can to make sure to protect other people's property. So really, you could have figured this out on your own. But there are people who would rather not figure it out on their own, people who would rather be very literal and say, okay, so I'm only obligated to avoid harm, I'm not obligated to help at all. So he says the Torah is specifically addressing those people, the people who would not come to this on their own and would say, okay, so I'm only obligated to not hurt, I'm not obligated to help. So the Torah says, no, you people stop hiding. You people stop saying that you're not obligated to help. You're obligated to help also. You have a mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda. And if you would have figured this out on your own, says Rav Moshe, so then great, free mitzvah. Now the Torah specifically gives you an extra mitzvah that you would have done anyway, but is now codified as a mitzvah, so it also, it's a win-win situation for you. So if you would not have figured this out on your own, so the Torah emphasizes stop hiding, you should not be begedder with his salamta. And if you would have figured it out on your own, so then you will get the extra zchus that now the Torah gives you a specific mitzvah that that you should be credited with. And then that mitzvah is Hashayv Teshivayim La'achicha, that you should return it to your brother, which the next pasuk repeats, ending off a Hashayv Osolo, that you shall return it to him. So this mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda, so this refers to a specific context. You see something that's lost, you have an obligation to return it. But the phrase Hashavas Aveda is invoked in a lot of other contexts, and sometimes specifically derived and connected to these psukim where we have the mitzvah. Rav Asher Weiss, Shlita, in his Sefer Minchas Asher, so he has a whole listing over there in Parshas Kiseitse of the many other contexts in which this is invoked outside of a straight found a lost object or returner context and many other discussions. But among the places where this comes up is, first of all, it comes up in terms of Hatzalas Gufo, that if you see somebody whose life is at risk, you see somebody who's drowning, so you have to save them. And that even though we know that already, because the Torah says Lo Samar Al Dam Riecha, that we shouldn't stand by when somebody is at mortal risk. So nonetheless, you might think, says the Gemara, that that means, okay, so if you could easily stop it, you should stop it. But if you're going to expend any effort towards it, how would you know you have such an obligation? So it's a Kal V'chomer from Hashav V'Saveda, the same way that if somebody's property is lost, you're going to have to exert yourself to some extent to make sure that you can fix it. So too, if somebody's life is at risk, a Kal V'chomer, so for sure you're going to have to expend the effort to fix it. And that's also, as the Gemara has in Maseches Nedarim, as one of the makaros for the obligation of refuah. As you have to heal people. If you're a qualified doctor, if you know what you can do in order, or maybe if you're somebody who can help pay for a doctor, if you're somebody who can make a difference, if somebody is sick and you can push them in the direction of refuah, so that's also considered to be a kal v'chomer from Hashav V'Saveda, that's for sure something that you're going to want to do. The Gemara in Bava Kamma Darshan's the Pasuk and Parshas Mishpatim, Verapo Yirape. The Gemara there says, Mikan Shiesh Rishus L'Rofe L'Rapos, that there's a heter for the doctor to treat. So that's the whole discussion, why do we need such a heter? So some understand that it's a philosophical point. You maybe would have thought that Kadosh Baruch Hu wants the person to be sick, maybe I shouldn't get involved. So some understand, no, that's why the Pasuk is telling us that you shouldn't make philosophical judgments like that. Others understand it from a Choshen Mishpat perspective, that if a person is, let's say, a surgeon, he's going to cut somebody up. So how do we know you have a right to do that? So you have good motivations, but maybe you have no right to be chovel on somebody, have no right to cut up a person because your ultimate goal is to make them better. So that's perhaps another reason why you might need a heter of refuah. But that's one thing, that there's a heter for whatever reason we need it. So the Gemara has reshus rofe l'rapos. But separately from that, there's also a mitzvah. There's an obligation of the rofe l'rapos, and that's perhaps derived, as the Gemara in the Nedarim indicates, derived from this pasuk of Hashiv Osolo. We also understand that in the context of monetary property, as the Gemara in Eil Metzias will make clear, that it doesn't just mean that if you see some object, you pick it up and you give it back to them, but also if you see some type of hezek that is coming towards the person's property, and you have the ability to stop it, so then that's also considered to be, you see they left their iPad out on the lawn and it's about to rain, so then you bring it in, you do something, or you cover it up, you do something that can protect it from being damaged. So that's also considered to be a kal v'chomer, or a direct relationship to Hashav V'Saveda, that the same way you're going to give back the monetary value, so you're also going to stop the monetary value from disappearing because it's going to be damaged from some outside force. This was also utilized by the Stipler and a few others. There is a big discussion. If we were learning Bava Kamma this year, and we're learning Bava Kamma Daf Beis, this would have been our opening topic. That the Torah tells us in Parshas Mishpatim that if I damage somebody's property in a number of different ways, so I'm obligated to pay for the property. But the Torah doesn't make clear anywhere that it's prohibited. Torah doesn't make clear anywhere that if I want to be the person damaging the property, that I'm not allowed to do it. It just says that if I do it, I have to pay for it. So how do I know that I'm not allowed to do it? So it's a big discussion. Sorry? So that's how the Sma says. You know, there's some who say that it's v'haftarecha kamocha. There's a lot of basis to say like that. There are a number of different suggestions. Again, if we want to build a comma, we go through all of them. But the Stipler, the one he likes, is he likes this pasuk. He thinks it's a kal v'chomer from Hashav v'Saveda, that if you have an obligation to return the value that was lost, so certainly then we see you also have an obligation to stop loss from happening. So it seems like it's a pretty straight kal v'chomer that you should not be the one causing the loss. So he understood that he thinks that, this is really the best of the Makaris. He goes through some of the various possibilities. He thinks this is the best of the Makaris, the Hashivos Alo. It's a straight Kal V'chomer that you can't be the one causing the loss. You have to figure out whether it totally answers the question, because you could say if you're willing to pay for it, so right, then maybe there's no loss. I mean, there's a loss to the world. It's about Tashkis, but it's not necessarily a loss to this person. So part of the complexity of that issue is you have to figure out how you're asking the question. The question about the Isser Mazik is asked in different ways. So some are asking it in terms of that. If I'm causing somebody a loss by damaging his stuff, how do I know that's Asa? So that's probably easier to answer. But the Sfarim also want to know, what if I have my checkbook ready? I write a check in advance. I say, here, I'm about to smash in your windshield. Here's the check to cover the damages. So am I allowed to do that? Am I allowed to cause this hezek if I'm ready to pay for it? Maybe the Torah just says I have to pay for the nezikin, but it doesn't tell me that I'm not allowed to be the one causing it. So if I'm going to not pay for it, so it's easier to find the mucker and to say that there's something wrong with that. But if I'm paying for it, you have to explain it perhaps a little bit more. So it's not so clear whether this mucker totally covers this. This mucker seems to address if somebody is undergoing a financial loss, so you have an obligation to try to stop it, an obligation to reverse it if you can, and an obligation then certainly not to be the person who's causing it. Okay, so it's a bit of a common discussion, so maybe we'll have someday an opportunity to go into a little more detail about that. There are other dinim that are also derived in the later Svarim from this concept of Hashav v'Saveda. The Menachas Chinuch and the Maram Shik assume that save somebody from spiritual harm, from harm in Ruchnius, to be involved in Kiruv, to be involved in anything that will prevent people from suffering in the spiritual realm, is also a fulfillment of Hashav v'Saveda. And there's also a discussion in the context of Gneva. The Shulchan Aruch says that, let's say you witness Reuven stealing something from Shimon, and then somehow what Shimon lost, what Reuven stole, so Reuven gives it to you to hold. Reuven shows you, hey, look what I just stole. So now you have an obligation to take that and give it back to the person who was originally robbed, because that's also considered to be Hashav v'Saveda. So what's the difference? The Chiddush is just that you might think that the Chi of Hashava only applies to lost property, that something somebody dropped. See that even if he was robbed, but you have the ability to reverse that, you have the ability to give it back to him, so there's also a Chi of Hashav v'Saveda. Some also say, Rav Ashwaitz also notes on his list, that we have an obligation, the Torah says, that if you have a ability to help somebody out in court, you have testimony that you could provide for somebody, so then you're obligated to do so. We say, Im lo yagir v'nasa avono, that if you don't provide the testimony, so then you're in trouble. But it's not always clear when that obligation applies. There are sometimes that you don't necessarily have a straight issur of Im lo yagir v'nasa avono. So some suggest that even if it's not a case where there actually is such a din, is still perhaps the concept of Hashav v'Saveda, that if you can rectify somebody's problems by testifying on their behalf, maybe that's a fulfillment at least of Hashav v'Saveda. Hi.
Is that talking about only in our coast? Because what about the Tonin that we were talking about earlier?
So the Tonin should be helping.
They're not allowed to be in like that.
Right, so the question of what you mean by helping, the issue that we talked about yesterday is that the Batei Din feel that they're hurting or that they're helping in a way that is unfair to the other side. That if it's just a question of assisting and bringing about justice, So then, presumably, anybody who can help bring about actual justice is Hashem Vesareida. The concern that the Bate Din have about the Tohanim is that the Tohanim are obscuring the justice, that if they're going to speak on behalf of somebody who might be lying, and now the Bezdin won't be able to figure out who's lying because.
So that's kind of like the policy of, let's say, the Based in America or something, but not really like a halakha concept of the Based in that you should try to win the Tohanim.
Well, I think it's probably a little bit of both. You know, they're certainly coming from a halakhic perspective, but it is a question of policy. There's a policy based on halakhic issues. But I think everyone would agree on all the principles. The question is how the principles play out. That anything that you can do to bring about justice, you should do. That's Hashem Saveda. But the question is what enhances justice and what kind of gets in the way. And that's the, especially when, as we were discussing in that context, that the Dayan also has a responsibility to look for Sheker. So then the question is how do all those parts come together? The Ra'ah also invoked that even in the context of Eidus, giving testimony for somebody who needs it is also a mitzvah of chesed, just parenthetically. So either that applies even if there's no mitzvah in Lo'yagav and Asa Agono, or even if there is such a mitzvah, but perhaps that whole mitzvah is really also an extension of the concept of chesed. So it could be it's both Hashavas Aveda and chesed, and sometimes also a mitzvah of Lo'yagav and Asa Agono. Rav Asher Weiss, again in that sefer, and the following siman, you can take a look, it's a longer discussion, but he also gets into the whole story of, so the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda, so is that specifically the mitzvah of giving it back? Or should we assume that the other steps in the mitzvah are also, the other steps in the process, are also part of the mitzvah, because the Torah says, V'yasafta el toch beisecha, that you should bring it into your house. So this bringing it into your house, is that part of the mitzvah? Or that's the hechsher mitzvah? So there's a whole discussion what a possible nafkaminas could be. The truth is, he doesn't mention this, but even if you want to say it's a hechsher mitzvah, it's something that you do as a preparation for a mitzvah, so it may still have a higher status, because the netziv, in the context of building a sukkah, has a famous chiddush, where the Netziv says in his commentary to the Shiltas that there's basically three categories. We'll probably have an opportunity to talk about this in the context of the Yom Tovim a little bit. That there are actions that are mitzvos, and there are actions that are hechsher mitzvos, things that are there to prepare for a mitzvah, it's not a mitzvah itself. But if the Torah specifically talks about it, so that has a higher status than a normal hechsher mitzvah. It's called a hechsher mitzvah haksuva b'kra. There are some nafkaminas that he notes between the two categories. So, in any event, clearly the Torah does talk about this. The Torah talks about picking it up and bringing it into your house. So that at least has the status, really, of a hechsher mitzvah, ksuva b'kra, which is either a quasi-mitzvah or an actual mitzvah. This is somehow significant as part of the process. The Torah also says that im lo karav achicha elacha v'lo yidato. So Alpi Derech HaDrush, the Aznayim LaTorah comments that you see from there that the assumption is that you should know the people around you, that you should have a relationship with your neighbors, you should know the people who are close to you. So the Torah is saying you don't know him because he's not close to you. But if he was close to you, the assumption is that you should know him, that you should have a friendly relationship with him, if possible. Okay, so the Torah also says here that you should hold on to it. This is something we'll definitely get into in the context of Eilu Metzius. The Torah says that you should bring it into your house and you should hold on to it ad rosh achicho, so until your neighbor should come and ask for it. So he should be doreshit. So this idea of drosh, so the Gemara understands that you have to darshan him, that you have to be doreshim, you have to examine the person, that you're not allowed to just assume that a person who comes and asks for something is telling the truth. This is very relevant also not only to the second parak of Bamitziah, but it's relevant to the first parak of Bamitziah, as we'll see, it will come up a little bit next week, probably in that context also, that if somebody comes and asks for property and says, I lost it, so you're not allowed to say, okay, so then it's probably yours. But you have to be Darish, you have to examine a little bit, and you have to say, tell me, what did it look like, or where did you leave it, give me some kind of proof, which is what we call in halacha simanim. He has to have some type of indication that he can prove through his knowledge that this item belongs to him. an interesting question. The Pnei Yehoshua and Ksubis raises a question, again, to get into some first part about Metziah terminology, that maybe we should say that you shouldn't have to do this because you have a situation here of a Bari Veshema, that the person who comes and claims that it's his, so he's a Bari, and the person who found it, so he doesn't have any reason to think it's not that person, so he knows he found it, he knows it belongs to somebody else, so the Motzi Aved is a Shema. So why shouldn't we say that if we assume in general, which is a whole discussion of itself, that somebody who is coming with a definite claim, a Bari, is more powerful than somebody who doesn't have a definite claim, a Shema. So let's say the person who's claiming he lost it should have more credibility than the person who found it and who has no idea who originally lost it. So that was an issue that the Pnei Yehoshua raised. And Rav Shimon Shkap, who was a rabbi here in Yeshiva for a year, but was more well known for his career in the Talz Yeshiva. So Rav Shimon Shkap in his Shari Yosher, so he explains that when you're dealing with Hashavas Aveda, this is a good introductory comment also to Yom Tzias, but Hashavas Aveda is not a straight momentous concept. There's an extra mitzvah here. It's kind of a Yoredeya type of mitzvah. There's an obligation of Hashavas Aveda which transcends some of the normal rules of momentous, and that is something that will play a role in some of our first part discussions as well, that Hashavas Aveda doesn't necessarily follow all the straight rules of Choshen Mishpat sometimes, because there is a Yoredeya component to it, there is a mitzvah component to it. And that mitzvah is represented here, this obligation to ask for Siman and to make sure that the person who's asking for it is not a Rami, he's not a liar, but that he really is somebody who actually did lose it. We'll get into the Gemara in Bav Metzia, it's a well-known Gemara, where the Gemara says that there's an exception to this, that if a person is known to be honest, which is a Tzurvim Midrabanim, is a Tamil Chacham, the assumption of the Tamil Chacham is always honest, so the person is known to be honest, so then you don't necessarily have to ask for proof, then you can believe him with a Tvias Ayin. He can look at the item and he can say, yeah, I recognize that, it's mine, you're allowed to trust him. And it's the context you're probably familiar with the Gemara. We'll have an opportunity, hopefully, to discuss it. And the Gemara says that there are certain areas where a person can fudge the truth and he's still going to be considered honest. It's not going to take away from his reputation. So if it's, the Gemara says, Achsanya, if somebody gave him a great meal, and he doesn't want to tell the whole world where he got this great meal because the person will become besieged. So he has the right to fudge that. Or if he wants to misrepresent his learning downward, he wants to say that he hasn't learned as much as he has learned, which sounds like it's because of anivus. So he has the right to do that as well. It's called the Masechta. And the third one probably has to do with marital relations, called Puraya. So he has the right to misrepresent, to not fully inform others who want to know about those matters. So he has the right to be less than forthcoming, and he won't be considered a dishonest person. We'll still trust him if he says the property is his. So that's a big sugya. When we look at the Gemara in Metziah, so we'll go into a little bit more detail about some of that. Hi.
Also, you just reminded me, I think also there's a YouTube that says like a woman's allowed to say she's mikudesha, so that people won't like go and
right, so that's probably also relevant. We have to figure out why the Gemara lists some things and not other things. Is there some type of overarching principle? So there are certain areas where apparently you can say something that's not true and it's not going to be held against you. So for some reason, and the Rishonim talk about it, that the Gemara focuses on these three. But the point is that in general, if a person has a reputation for always telling the truth, he's not Mishana B'Diburo, so then you can trust him when he claims the object is his, even if he can't otherwise prove it. And there's a whole discussion as to what a person has to do in order to be able to establish that. Also, in the introduction to Ilam Metzias Vein, so the pasuk then says, "V'chein tase lechamoro, v'chein tase lesimlaso, v'chein tase lechol avedus achicha, asher tova b'menu, u'masasa lo sucha lehisalem." Say that this is what you should do to his animal, this is also what you should do to his garment, to a dress. And the Gemara derives from here, believe it or not, really the concept of Yeish, that if you have a garment, so a garment a person can recognize. Even though nowadays it's not so true. Nowadays the garments are mass-produced in a sweatshop in China. Everything looks exactly the same. But once upon a time they were handmade and they had distinctive appearances. So a person would see a garment, he could recognize that it's a unique garment. So a person would have hope that it would be returned. And the Gemara seems to understand from there that if something is not so distinct, if something is going to get lost and no one's going to be able to tell the difference because everything looks the exact same, so then that's going to impact his ability to get it back. So that's the concept of Yeish. So God willing, we will get into that a little bit more. One of the major themes in the second parak of Bav Metzia. So to move on to the next pasuk in this Aliyah, so the Torah tells us the prohibition of Begadisha and Begadish. Torah says, Lo yiach li gever al isha, v'lo yilbash gever simlas isha, ki so avas Hashem elokecha kolos le'ele. A person is not supposed to either engage in behaviors or wear garments of the opposite gender, which is understood as being a entryway into znus. That's how Rashi quotes from the Sifri, that this is connected to licentious behavior. Sab Merav has a discussion about whether this should be categorized as what we call Gzeirah Min HaTorah. I don't know if we had an opportunity yet to talk about it this year, but I tend to talk about it a lot, that there are mitzvos in the Torah which may have a different nature than other mitzvos. Now we know that normally we have mitzvos in the Torah or Isurim in the Torah, and then we have the rabbinic prohibitions, and the rabbinic prohibitions are often there to protect the mitzvos, so we shouldn't come to violate the mitzvos. So that's how we normally understand the function of rabbinical law. So are there any mitzvos in the Torah that also serve that function, that even though they're in the Torah itself and not dinim d'rabbanim, but nonetheless they are there to protect other mitzvos in the Torah? Right. So yichud might be such a, would probably be such an example. It's a whole discussion. The Gemara assumes yichud is a daraisa, so you have to figure out how the Gemara sees it in the psukim. That's a whole discussion, but the Gemara in Kedushin traces yichud to a pasuk in Chumash. So that would seem on the surface to be an example of something which is an isser in the Torah, but it's there to prevent other isurim. So Rabbi Yosef Engel, who we mentioned yesterday, Rabbi Yosef Engel, in one of his sfarim called the Lekach Tov, so he has a classic essay, Klal Ches, where he takes up this question. He says, do you ever find anywhere in the Torah where you have a prohibition, and the prohibition is not for its own sake, it's really there to prevent another prohibition? So he says, yeah, let me think about it for a minute, and he comes up with about 17, 18 examples. And there was another sefer called the Shuvas Yad Moshe, had his own list, so if you put together all the lists, you could probably get 35, 40 examples of dinim in the Torah which serve that purpose. And the Sabbat Rav has a tshuva where he discusses that it sounds like this is probably another such example, but nonetheless, he assumes that you would say lo plug, that even if you characterize it as a gezeira, but it's still a din in the Torah, so therefore across the board, even if one's purpose is not for the purposes of znus, nonetheless, the fact that that's, especially since it's not stated in the Chumash, that's the purpose, that's the way Chazal understood it, so even if that's not the purpose, nonetheless, there is such a prohibition. The Netziv, in his commentary over here, so the Netziv notes that, so the Torah says, lo yiach gever al isha, a woman should not walk around, let's say, as Chazal understand, with a weapon, acting in a way that a man acts. V'lo yilbash gever simlas isha, and a man should not wear the clothes of a woman. So then it goes on to say, ki tov as Hashem elokecha kolo se'ela, because all of these things are unpleasing to God. So the Netziv says, it's a funny language, it lists two things, and then it says all these things. So all is not usually a language for two things. So he suggests it's really four things, that each of these are bilaterally served. There's two bilaterally served. There's an isser to act in a manner that is associated with the other gender, that is considered to be bilateral. So the pasuk refers to klegever alisha, but it applies in both directions, a male acting like a female or vice versa. And then he understands that that's a gateway, that's to accustom one then to the next step, which is to actually dress like the other gender. So he says, so that's also a bilateral prohibition, which is phrased here in terms of lo yilbash gever simlas isha, but it applies in both directions. So you really have essentially four prohibitions in this pasuk, that neither gender should act in a way that is associated with the other gender, and neither gender should dress in a way that's associated with the other gender.
Does he explain why it is that each gender, like,
gets its own issur?
No, why like that specific gender for that specific issur?
I mean, in terms of why does the Torah phrase it, how does it choose which one gets which? Now that he doesn't explain, it's a good question. So why should it be that we should assume that if we're going to talk about the acting, so we're talking about the issur and we're talking about the dress and we're talking about the man? It's a good question. It's the whole discussion that there were some who allowed this on Purim. Maybe Purim creates a different kind of context. Others weren't so excited about this. It's a whole discussion. We could get more into that Purim time. Hi, as you were going to ask? Okay, so, perfect. So, as a whole discussion, I mean, you do have such an idea in Poskim that Purim creates a different atmosphere for some purposes, and others weren't so excited about this. Then, just before we finish this Aliyah, so we get to one of the most mysterious mitzvahs in the Torah, really a topic of a lot of discussion, and a lot of detail. There are several entire svarim, believe it or not, that are written about this next mitzvah, which I don't know how many of us have fulfilled in our lives, but the mitzvah of Kan Tzipor, of sending away the mother bird. So the Torah says here, Ki kare Kan Tzipor lefanecha baderech b'chaleitz v'ala aretz efrochim v'veitzim v'ha'em revetzis ala efrochim ola veitzim lo sikach ha'em ala banim. So if you should encounter a nest, and the mother bird is there on top of the eggs or on top of the chicks, and you want to take them, so you shouldn't take them without first sending. We should take them while the mother is there. Then the Torah says, "Shalech tishalach haseim." Rather, you should send away the mother. V'yas habanim tikach lach uman yitav lach v'harach tiyamim, and then you can take the children. So then things will be good for you, and you should have a long life. So there is a lot to try to figure out about this mitzvah, and a lot to try to figure out about the psukim. So first of all, there's a whole discussion of what it means, ki karei. And the Torah seems to say that should you stumble upon it, so then this is going to apply. So the Gemara in Maseches Chulin, and Daf Kuf Lamed Tes, so among other things, it says, ki karei, so you might think that maybe I should go searching, I should go up in the mountains, I should go out into the forest, I should go walking around until I find such a nest so that I could fulfill the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKan. So the Torah says no, that if you happen to stumble upon it, so then that's when you're going to do it. So the Chavos Yair has a comment, it was a controversial comment. The Chavos Yair says, what do you see in this drasha? That apparently if you do encounter a bird in a nest, so you have an obligation to send it away.
And
then to take the egg. That's what it sounds like, right? So you would have thought maybe not that way, right? You would have thought that it's only if I'm interested in the eggs, if I want to take the eggs, and I want it to, or I want to take the chicks, so then I have to send away the mother. But if I'm not interested, why should I bother the mother? So then I should leave it alone. You would think that it's a mitzvah like tzitzis. If a person is wearing a four-cornered garment, so then he has an obligation to wear tzitzis. A person is interested in eating meat, so then he has an obligation to shech the animal. But it's not necessarily an obligation that you have to seek out. So this was a major machlokas, that on the one hand you have the Chavos Yair who read this Gemara this way, and you have others who disagreed. You have others such as the Chassam Sofer and the Chazon Ish and the Netziv and his commentary to Chumash. Many others disagreed with this, and they assumed that the mitzvah only applies if you okay. The mitzvah only applies anyway. The mitzvah only applies if you're interested in taking the eggs. And nowadays, this tends to play out a little bit like a Hasidic Misnagdish focus, with the Misnagdish poskim often following the view that it only applies if you're interested in taking the eggs, and the Chassidim having a tendency more to understand it as a mitzvah even if you're not interested in taking it. But the Chavos Yair's point is that if the Gemara says you might have thought that you have to go searching in the mountains and in the forest, so why would I think that if I'm only obligated if I want to take the eggs? So then for sure I don't have to go searching for one. It's only if I found one and I want it. So the whole nature of that drush, the Chavos Yair thought that means to show you that if you actually come across it, then you have an obligation regardless. It's only telling you that you don't have to go seek it out. So that was a whole discussion whether or not that proof is compelling. The Makor Chaim, the Nesivis, and the Sefer on Hilchos Pesach. So he took this to mean that this is a special drasha by this mitzvah, saying that this mitzvah you don't have to seek out. But you see from here that other mitzvahs you have to seek out. There was a whole discussion in general whether if a person is not currently confronted with a mitzvah, so you have an obligation of chasing after a mitzvah, of being rodef after mitzvahs. So he understood from here that this is the case, that it's only by Shiluach HaKan that the Gemara is telling you you don't have to go look for one. But apparently by other mitzvahs you do. So others didn't find that so compelling, but they found that that here it's a specific need from the Pesukim in order to clarify that. It doesn't necessarily reflect other mitzvahs, what the story would be. Hi.
You also based on that it's fairly rare mitzvah.
I'm sorry?
I mean, it could be based on other mitzvahs. More common occurrences, Lashank and...
Right, so there are other reasons within this pasuk to explain why you would need that. So others did not find this so compelling. There's also a medrash which says explicitly not that way. The medrash says, Bake Shalom V'rad Fehu, that the pasuk says in Tehillim that you have to chase after peace. So says the medrash that the Torah didn't tell us we have to chase after mitzvos. The Torah just told us we have to chase after peace. So mitzvos you only have to do if they confront you, if you find yourself obligated. But peace you have to chase after. So once in a sefer, the sefer Zivchei Shlomo, was written by Shlomo Zalman Friedman, where he suggested that that's the reason you don't have to chase after mitzvos is because no one person can fulfill all the Torah mitzvos anyway. Torah mitzvos don't apply to any one person by himself. Certainly b'zman hazeh, but even at any point in history, they don't apply to anybody as an individual. So you would think, how could any of us fulfill all the mitzvahs of the Torah? So the answer is, we don't have to fulfill all the mitzvahs of the Torah, because we're a part of Klal Yisrael. We're a part of the one ichud of the Jewish people. So others are fulfilling mitzvahs that we don't get to fulfill, so it's as if we're a part of that as well. But that only works if you have achdus. That only works if you have shalom. So first the Torah says you do have to chase after peace, because you have to create one entity among the Jewish people. But once you do that, then you don't have to chase after mitzvahs, because you're connected to all the mitzvahs, even the ones that you're not confronted with, because of this concept of the achdus to the Jewish people. Nature of the question?
That would be very interesting to apply to the Yishuv.
That would be fascinating. Yeah, that's a separate discussion, whether it's a mitzvah chiyuvis, a mitzvah kiyumis in general.
Right.
But then the question of if a mitzvah is designated not as...
Once we have the opportunity to do something, people are doing it.
Correct. And then it gets into a whole discussion of how you... hashkafically, halachically understand that mitzvah. But once you designate a mitzvah, let's say, as kiyumis, as voluntary, so then is there any inyan to chase after it? So that's a whole discussion, which ties into this point a little bit. So the Mekor Chaim thought that this was a proof, but other mitzvahs you have to chase after, you just don't have to chase after Shiluach HaKan. And others didn't find that to be so compelling. Some thought that it's quite the opposite, that some thought that actually the Gemara has a drasha that prat b'mezumen, that if you have an animal that's in your property, it's part of your chicken coop, let's say, it's part of your possessions, so then you don't have such an obligation. So pashas, that just means that we're excluding from this mitzvah something that's a part of your chicken coop, so to speak. But some understood that to mean that Yadavka can't seek it out. That's the same idea, that it only comes up if you happen to occasion it on the way. So this was a whole debate about how you understand the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKan. Is it a mitzvah which you have an obligation to do if you're confronted with it? Or should we assume, which again, most of the, I think, contemporary Mishnah posts can understand, that it's only if you're interested in taking the eggs or the chicks that you have an obligation to send away the mother, but not otherwise. So it's probably connected, and this is something of Usher Weiss, again, to mention him one more time, has a very nice piece about this in a Sefer and Dvarim as well. It's probably connected to the major question of what is the Tameh HaMitzvah, what exactly is the purpose of this mitzvah of Shiluach HaKan. So that was a whole discussion. The easiest thing to say, and something that many Rishonim asserted very strongly, is that it's about the Rachmanis. It's about that we want to have compassion on the bird. The bird shouldn't have to watch while we take away its children. But the challenge to that, even though the Rambam and the Moreh Nevuchim very much said like this, and the Ramban said like this, and the Chinuch said like this, many said this was the case, but the challenge, which I think Aaron was about to say, is that the Mishnah sounds a little bit against this, because the Mishnah says in Brachos that if somebody inserts into his tefillah that Haomer, I can't see Yagi Rachmecha, that God, you're so great that your rachmanis even extends to birds in the context of this mitzvah, so then mishaskinos, so we say you shouldn't say that. So and the Gemara mentions a couple of explanations why that is. One explanation the Gemara gives is that it's because he is trying to understand God's mitzvot this way, while really einan elo gezeros, just gezeros, however you want to translate that. So does that mean that the mitzvah is not about rachmanis? So the Rambam didn't think it meant that, so it's a whole discussion what exactly it means. Some understand that it's no problem to say it's about rachmanis. It's a problem to insert it in tefillah. That if you put it in the context of tefillah, so you're saying it as if you know it absolutely, and that's limiting the mitzvah, maybe it's limiting the tefillah also. So that's inappropriate. That's all the Mishnah meant. But it didn't mean to say that in the context of learning or believing or other contexts, if there's anything wrong with assuming that this is about the Rachmanis. Rav Asher Weiss in that Sefer, so he understands that it is about compassion for the animal. We say gzeros to emphasize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's compassion is different than human compassion. Human compassion, people feel a need to be compassionate. They feel like they're going to, hopefully they feel that they're going to suffer if they can't express their compassion, if they feel something is in need. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is above that. HaKadosh Baruch Hu decides to be compassionate. That's what the Gemara means. They're gzeros. So we shouldn't confuse what Rachmanis means, the human compassion and the supernatural compassion of God. So that's what the Mishnah is telling us. But assume that this is for a compassionate goal. So they thought there wasn't necessarily a problem, and maybe that's indeed the case. Others disagreed. And others said that it has some other goal to it. The Vilna Gaon, in his studies, the Vilna Gaon understood it to be that this was actually unpleasant for the bird. The bird is actually going to suffer more by being sent away. So in essence, it's the opposite of Rachmanis, but nonetheless, it's a commandment anyway. I have to figure out exactly why. But he explained in that context why it is that the two mitzvot that we're told that you will live a long life, Kibbur Av Ve Aim and Shiluach HaKan, it's because they're davka two opposites. So Kibbur Av Ve Aim is something which is very intuitive and very rational in terms of fairness. So your parents do good things for you, so you show gratitude to them. And Shiluach HaKan is the opposite. So it's essentially being cruel. So if somebody's able to submit to God's will in both opposite directions, so then they have a reward of a long life. It was the same comment that he applied to Avraham Avinu, that after Avraham Avinu passes the 10th test of the Akedah, so then he's told, now I know, the Malach said, now I know that you're Yirei Elokim, now I know that you're Avir HaShemayim. So it seems unfair. He passed already 9 tests before this. So it took him 10 tests to be established as a Yirei HaShemayim. So the Vilna Gaon explained in the same spirit that all the other tests, so it could have just been that his natural personality was to be a compassionate, nice person, and therefore it didn't necessarily challenge his teva with any of those tests. But the Akedah was going in the opposite direction. So if he's able to pass all these tests together, so you say he's, we see that he's a Yirei Elokim. So too, both this mitzvah together with Kibbur Av Ve Aim, that shows that a person really is submitting himself to God's will. So the Zohar has a comment where the Zohar says that the purpose of Shiluach HaKan is that the bird that is going to be sent wandering around, it's going to be sent flying around, disconnected and dislodged from its residence. So that is ma'orer rachamim. That somehow evokes, and this is really beyond our understanding to relate to, but it evokes divine compassion on behalf of the whole world. The whole world will be better off because it's essentially pushing a button on divine rachmanis. So even though it's not so helpful for the bird, but it somehow has an effect in this way. So it could be, as the Minchas Asher discusses, that maybe this whole question of is it a mitzvah to do regardless, or is it a mitzvah to do only if you're interested in the eggs, probably correlates to this somewhat, that if you think it's about a requirement to evoke this divine rachmanis, so maybe that's irrelevant to whether or not you're interested in the eggs. But if it's about that you should have compassion on the bird shouldn't be there when you take away the eggs, so then that itself is perhaps only relevant if you plan on actually taking the eggs. And so that might perhaps be relevant to understanding it. The Sefer Aznayim LaTorah, Rabbi Zalman Saratzkin, we mentioned before, so he has another interesting spin, more along the Rachmanis line, but a little bit differently. So he emphasizes the fact that the Torah emphasizes that the mother ha'im rovetzes, and so the mother is staying there on top of the eggs. So you could say, so why is the mother doing this? It sees a person coming with a predatory intent, so she's putting her life at risk. She should really fly away. She should fly away on her own. So the truth is, really she should, but she has more compassion for her children than for herself. That the mother is sacrificing or risking her own life in order to protect her children. So suggests the Aznayim LaTorah that the idea is you should not exploit that to her disadvantage. So you might think, okay, I see a mother and some eggs. I have a whole meal here. I can take the chicken, I can take the eggs, I can take everything. And the bird, the adult bird, is strong enough to fly away on her own, but is choosing not to, so great, so free bird. So I can take the bird together with the eggs. So the Torah is saying, no, send away the mother, that you cannot take advantage of this chesed, the fact that the mother is showing rachmanis for her children, and therefore endangering her own life in order to protect the children. So it would be wrong, hashkafically, morally, it would be wrong from a midos perspective for the person to say, okay, because this mother is sacrificing herself for the children, now I can take the mother too. So no, you have to send away the mother. And that's why he says, the Gemara notes that if later on you want to use a net and catch the mother after the mother has been sent free, you're allowed to do that. But to exploit the sacrifice of the parent, to say, okay, because the mother is sacrificing herself to protect the children, I'll take advantage of that, I'll chop her too. So that's wrong. And then he goes on to say in the following comment, in the same vein, that's also the relationship between Kibbud Av V'Em and this mitzvah, which are both considered to be a source of Arichus Yamim in the Torah, because they both reflect the same ideal, that the parent is very self-sacrificing on behalf of the child, and the child is obligated to have Hakaras HaTov and appreciation for that, and to show recognition. And we show that to our own parents through Kibbud Av V'Em, and we show that to the mother bird by not exploiting that quality to her disadvantage and by not capturing her because of that. So that's what he suggests could be relevant to that as well. Just mention one or two more points just about this. So we mentioned before a suggestion that if the animal is there in your house and is mezumin, so the Gemara says you're pater, but that some interpret that to mean that you, in essence, can't seek out the situation. It has to happen by accident. So that Nelson Gestetner, who will probably quote a lot over the year, Nelson Gestetner was a great posek in Bnei Brak, passed away about 2 years ago. So in his Sefer Lahoris Nasan on Chumash, so he notes that this is an interesting mitzvah. Right? That here you have a mitzvah to do something which you essentially then have no control over. You can only do it if it happens to come across to you by accident. If it happens to come across to you by circumstance, then you can do it. Otherwise, you can't seek it out at all, according to that opinion. So he suggests that there is a segue from here into the next Aliyah, which we'll have to talk about next year, but the beginning of Shlishi talks about the mitzvah of Makkah, about the obligation of building a fence around your house. And you want to do that so that you shouldn't have a dangerous situation. Somebody should fall off and chalila die. The Torah says, ki yipol ha-nofel mimenu. We have to worry about the one who's supposed to fall shouldn't fall. So what's that language, ki yipol ha-nofel? So Rashi says, roi zel yipol, that this person really deserved to fall for whatever reason. And Kodesh Baruch Hu had declared this person who falls should fall. But nonetheless, los eskalva misasol yadecha. You still don't want to be a part of it. You don't want it to happen through your negligence, because the Kodesh Baruch Hu works it out that meritorious people have good things come as a result of their actions and guilty people have bad things happen as their actions, and even if this person deserves to fall, you don't want it to be on your cheshbon, you don't want it to be on your cause. So this whole theme of Megalvon Schus Leidei Zakai says sometimes we see that we don't have direct control over the good things we do or the bad things we do. We can try to do good things and do bad things, but it's also a spiritual reality that the more good things you do, the more good opportunities you have, and the more bad things you do, the more bad things tend to be associated with your activities. So that reflects itself both in this concept of Makkah, and this concept of Kan Sipur, that it's a schus, but it's a schus which you can't orchestrate, maybe according to that minority view. It's a schus that you have to allow it to come about. If it comes about, you can respond. Otherwise, there isn't anything you can do to make it essentially present itself. I'll just add on one last point. It's a little bit of a complex point. If you take a look in the Ramban, if you look over Shabbos in the Ramban on this pasuk, so the Ramban has a lot to say. Again, this is one of the major hashkafically challenging mitzvos, especially because of that Mishnah that says that we shouldn't see it as Rachmanis, or it seems to imply that. So there's a lot of discussion about this mitzvah. So the Ramban has a lot to say, but in the end of his comments on this pasuk, so he quotes a medrash that understands aim shalech the shalachas aim. That refers to the aim of bina, the aim of understanding, that is in control of the world. V'yas habanim tikach lach. What is the banim? So the banim, he says, is a reference to the 7 days of Sukkot. So it's just a little yonah d'yoma. What exactly is that meant to represent? So there was a comment in the Sefer Toretz Maharitz, the Rabbi Yosef Zvi Dushinsky, in the Sefer Toretz Maharitz, understands it to mean as a remez to different stages of tshuva. That we have an idea that there is tshuva meyira and tshuva meyava. That tshuva meyira is about running away from your problem, so to speak, running away from your averos. And tshuva meyava is about the positive embrace of mitzvos. And some understand that Yom Kippur is a time of tshuva meyira, and then Sukkot right afterwards is a time of Shuva Me'ava. It's a time when we have so many active mitzvahs associated with sukkahs. It's a time when we focus on growth through positive activity. And therefore, it's considered to be a time of Shuva Me'ava. I've mentioned in the past that my oldest daughter was born on Erev Sukkot, so we gave her the middle name Ahuva in honor of Shuva Me'ava, because it's a time of Shuva Me'ava. So he suggests Alpi Derech Hadrush, the Torah is also hinting that person wants to have Laman Yitav Lach Varach Yamin. Person wants to have things work out well. He wants to have a long life. He wants to be spiritually meritorious. So it's not enough that he should run away from his averus. It's not enough that he should do Tshuva Meira, but he also has to do Tshuva Me'ava. He also has to find out which he can hold on to. He has to take something which can represent his positive activities. And otherwise it's not going to last. Otherwise it's not going to have any kind of enduring quality. But rather we're told that it's not only the Tshuva Meira he should engage in, it's also the Tshuva Me'ava, that he should find positive expressions of Avos Hashem that will carry him further. And that's what's very timely represented here in terms of the themes of Yom Kippur and Sukkot. Okay, so we got to the end of the Aliyah. Chaver from last year knows it's not always the case that we get anywhere near the end of the Aliyah, so that's an accomplishment. So I wish everyone a wonderful extended weekend.